You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is if you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide, and it is Collected Works, Volume 202, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 12, given in Dornach on the 19th of December, 1920. We stand there in the world as an observer on the one hand, and on the other as an active agent, and dwell between these two aspects in our feeling. In feeling, we are given up both to what our observation presents to us and our own actions. We need only reflect how we can be either satisfied or dissatisfied by the success or failure of our actions, how every action is accompanied by impulses of feeling, and we will find that our feeling nature does indeed connect these two opposite poles, the observing and the acting elements in us. Only by virtue of being observing beings do we become human in the full meaning of the word. To confirm this, you need only consider how all that ultimately gives you a sense of being human is connected with the fact that you can somehow inwardly mirror the world around you in which you live, can observe it. The idea that we might not be able to observe the world would mean having to divest ourselves of our whole humanity. As individuals who act, we are embedded in a social context. And everything we accomplish between birth and death basically has a certain social significance. As we know, thought lives within us insofar as we are observing beings, while will lives in us by our nature as socially coexisting beings. However, human nature and reality itself cannot be arranged in neatly compartmentalized categories, but instead we must characterize life from various angles. Things flow into one another. The powers at work in the world interact. In our thinking, we can conceive of ourselves as thinking beings and also as will beings. Yet even when we live in thoughts in absolute outward calm of contemplation, the will is continually active in us. And likewise, when we perform actions, thought is active in us. It is inconceivable for us to act, for something of us to affect our social context without us also identifying with what occurs in our thoughts. The nature of thought is implicit in all will nature, and will lives in every thought. If we seriously engage in building that bridge I have so often referred to between the moral spiritual world order and the physical natural world order, it is essential to be clear about what is involved here. Imagine for a moment that in pursuit of mainstream academic knowledge, you lived for a while in purely reflective thought, not moving or acting in any way, thus living a purely ideational existence. Nevertheless, will is still active in this life of ideas, albeit a will that works within you and expends its powers in the realm of pictures and thoughts. Especially when we consider how the thinker continually shines will into his thoughts, one thing about real life must become apparent to us. If we carefully examine all the thoughts we form, we will always find that they relate to something in our environment, something we have experienced. Between birth and death, in a sense, we don't really have any thoughts other than those which life brings us. If our experience is rich, we have a rich thought content, and poor if our experience is impoverished. The content of our thoughts is, in a sense, our inner destiny. But there is something completely individual to us in this thinking experience. The way in which we connect and separate thoughts, how we judge and draw conclusions, how we orient ourselves in thought, life in general. This belongs to us as a distinctive individual characteristic. The will in our thought life is our own. In considering our life of thought, a careful self-examination will show us that while the content of thoughts comes to us from without, it is we ourselves who work upon them, process them. Basically, therefore, our world of thoughts is entirely dependent on the experiences we can acquire through birth, the context of destiny we find ourselves in, and the experiences vouchsafed us in consequence. But what approaches us from the world around us is informed and penetrated by the will that shines out from the depths of our soul. For the purposes of self-knowledge, for fulfilling what is required, it requires of us, it is extremely important to distinguish clearly between these two things, the thought content that approaches us from without, and the power of our will, arising from within, that shines into this thought world. How do we grow ever more spiritual? Not by absorbing as many thoughts from the world as possible, for these thoughts really only reproduce our sensory and physical surroundings in images. We do not enhance our spirituality, our mental powers, by pursuing all the sensations life offers, but only by our inner, will-directed work upon and within these thoughts. Thus, meditation, too, does not involve giving oneself up to a random play of thought associations, but instead placing a few easily surveyed, easily tested thoughts at the center of our awareness. And the stronger and more intently we shine this inner will within the element where thoughts exist, the more spiritual we become. When we absorb thoughts from the outer physical and sensory world, and these are the only kind we can absorb between birth and death, we become unfree, as you can easily tell. For we are then given up to outer conditions and circumstances, and are obliged to think in the way the world dictates, surrendering to thought content. Our only freedom here involves inwardly working upon this content. Now, there is one way to become entirely free, inwardly, and this is by excluding, as far as possible, the thought content that comes to us from without, increasingly shutting it out, and at the same time especially enlivening and activating the will that shines through our thoughts whenever we form judgments and draw conclusions. By doing this, our thinking acquires the quality I described as pure thinking in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom. We are thinking, but only will lives in this thinking. I emphasize this especially in the 1918 edition of The Philosophy of Freedom. What lives in us there lives in the sphere of thinking. Yet, once it has become pure thinking, it can really equally well be described as will. In other words, we raise ourselves from thinking to will when we become inwardly free, in a sense making our thinking fully fledged enough for it to be entirely illumined by will. It then no longer exists by imbibing things from without, but lives in the element of will. And precisely by increasingly strengthening the will in thinking, we prepare our capacity for moral imagination, as I called it in The Philosophy of Freedom. And this reaches up to the moral intuitions which pervade and imbue our will become thought, or thought become will. By this means we raise ourselves from physical sensory imperatives, making what is intrinsically ours shine through us, and preparing ourselves for moral intuition. And on this depends our capacity to realize every impulse from the world of spirit that we are initially capable of realizing. Freedom, therefore, arises when we allow the will to inform our thinking to an ever greater, more powerful extent. If we study the human being from the other pole, that of the will, we can ask where it becomes most inwardly apparent to us through our actions. If we sneeze, you can say we're doing something, but we can scarcely ascribe any special will impulse to this. Whenever we speak, We do something which does, in a sense, involve will activity. But just consider how speaking involves both willed and unwilled activity, is simultaneously both will-directed and not. We learn to speak, and in doing so, have to get beyond intentionally shaping each individual word. And so a kind of instinctive activity enters our speaking. This is true at least in ordinary life, and basically it is true especially for those who make no particular effort to be spiritual. People who chat away thoughtlessly, who open their mouths on all occasions to utter whatever occurs to them without thinking too much about it, allow us to see, for they themselves do not see this, the extent to which speech can be instinctual and not governed by the will. The more we emerge from our organic nature and engage in activity that in a sense is released from this, the more we imbue our action with thinking. Sneezing is still entirely in the organic realm, and speaking too, while walking, is already greatly released from this organic realm, as are the movements of our hands. We can find a gradual transition toward actions increasingly released from our organism. We observe these actions with our thoughts, despite being unaware of how the will shoots into them. Unless we are sleepwalkers, performing actions while fast asleep, our actions will always be accompanied by thoughts. We carry our thoughts into our actions and do so increasingly the more our actions develop. And so we become ever more inward by sending our own intrinsic power as will into thinking, as it were allowing it entirely to shine through our thinking. We introduce will into thinking and thereby attain freedom. We do so by increasingly informing our actions with thoughts. We shine our thoughts through our actions, which arise, of course, from our will. On the one hand, inwardly, we live a life of thoughts, through which we shine will, thus finding freedom. On the other hand, outwardly, our actions flow forth from our will, and we pervade them with our thoughts. And there's a diagram. But how exactly do we increasingly develop our actions in this way? How, to use a contentious phrase, do we succeed in perfecting our actions? We can do this by developing within us the power that can only be described as devotion to the external world. The more our devotion to the outer world increases, the more this outer world will kindle our actions. But precisely by finding the way to devote ourselves to the outer world, we succeed in penetrating the nature of our actions with thoughts. What does it mean to be devoted to the external world? Devotion to the outer world that imbues us, that imbues our actions with thoughts, is nothing other than love. Just as we attain freedom by imbuing and illumining our thoughts with will, so we come to love by pervading our life of will with thoughts. In our actions we develop love by letting thoughts stream into will nature, and in our thinking we develop freedom by letting this will nature stream into our thoughts. And since we are whole human beings, a totality, so when we succeed in finding freedom in our life of thoughts and love in our life of will, then freedom participates in our actions and love participates in our thinking. They interfuse and illumine one another so that we accomplish thoughtful actions in love and will-imbued thinking from which in turn free actions can spring. Thus we find how the two greatest ideals of freedom and of love interfuse and cohere in us. As we stand in the world, freedom and love also are also what we can realize in ourselves in a way that enables the one to connect in the world through us with the other. The next question is how to achieve this highest ideal of a will-illumined life of thought. If thinking were something existing only in material processes, this could never be done, The will could not possibly find ever-increasing entry into the sphere of thinking and come to dwell there. If thinking were merely a material process, the will could at most exert an organizing effect upon it. The will can only be effective here if thought life as such has no outward physical reality, is devoid of all outer material reality. What is thinking if this is so? You will be able to see what it is, what it has to be, when you start with an image. Imagine a mirror here, and there an object reflected in it. If you go behind the mirror, there is, of course, nothing there. It is just a picture. Our thoughts are of this nature. What gives them their existence as pictures? You need only recall what I have said about thought life, which is not in any way an immediate reality in the present moment. Our life of thoughts shines in from our pre-birth existence, or let us say, from our existence before conception. Thought life has its reality between death and a new birth. And in the same way that an object is reflected in the mirror, and the mirror produces only pictures, so what we develop as our life of thoughts is basically a tangible reality between death and a new birth, and then only shines in from that realm in our life after birth. As thinking beings, we have only a reflected reality. This means that the other reality, which shines up from our metabolism, as you know, can penetrate the merely reflected reality of thought life. In seeking to develop open, unprejudiced thinking in general, something very rare today, however, and in particular, if we consider the purest mathematical thinking, we see most clearly that thought life is mirror-like. This mathematical thought life streams up entirely from within us, but has only a reflected existence. Through mathematics, you can define all external objects, and yet the mathematical thoughts themselves are mere thoughts and possess only the reality of pictures. They are something that is not acquired from any kind of outward reality. Abstract minds like Kant employed an abstract term, saying that mathematical ideas are a priori ones, which simply means they exist before or precede anything else. But why are mathematical ideas a priori? Because they shine in from pre-birth existence, or rather from the existence preceding conception, and this is what constitutes their a prioriness. They appear real to our awareness because the will illumines them. This illumination by the will makes them real. Just consider how abstract modern thinking has become, using abstract terms for things whose reality is not perceived or grasped. Kant did actually dimly sense that we bring mathematics with us from pre-birth existence, and this is why he called mathematical calculations a priori. But the term itself, a priori, tells us nothing much, points to no reality, but is merely formulaic. Old traditions refer to the life of thoughts, whose picture existence needs to be illumined by the will to become reality, as in quotes, appearance or maya, drawing page 158. If we look at the other pole of our existence, where thoughts radiate into will nature, and where we can accomplish things in love, we find that in a sense our consciousness is rebuffed by reality. Unless you resort to supersensible thinking, you cannot gaze into the realm of darkness, darkness for our awareness, where the will unfolds when you lift your arm or turn your head. You move your arm, but the complex process that occurs then remains as hidden from ordinary consciousness as the experience of deep, dreamless sleep. We observe our arm, we see how our hand can grasp hold of something, and all this is because we penetrate it with thoughts, with ideas, but the thoughts themselves in our consciousness remain just appearance here too. Reality is what we live within, which does not shine up into our ordinary awareness. Old traditions speak here of force, because while what we live in as reality is imbued with thoughts, thought is in some ways rebuffed by reality in our life between birth and death. Between these two lies the sensing heart, the balance, the mediating element, connecting what the will, in a sense, shines into the head, into thoughts, with our love-endowed actions. This is our feeling life, which can orient itself both toward will life and thought life. In our ordinary awareness, we live in an element by means of which we grasp, on the one hand, what comes to expression in our will-imbued thinking, with its inclination toward freedom, and on the other, where we try to increasingly penetrate with our thinking what passes into our actions. Since olden times, the connecting bridge between these two has been called wisdom. In his fairy tale titled The Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily, Goethe referred to these old traditions in the figures of the three kings, the golden, silver, and bronze king. On other occasions, from different angles, we have shown how these three elements, of which an ancient instinctive knowledge was aware, must be revived, albeit in a quite different form, and that this can only happen by human beings absorbing the insights gained from imagination, intuition, and inspiration. But what really occurs as we develop our life of thoughts? A reality becomes appearance. It is very important to be clear about this. On our shoulders we carry the head whose ossification and tendency to it already gives us an outward picture of something dead in comparison to the rest of our fresh and more vital organism. Between birth and death we carry in our head the influx from a preceding period, when it was reality and is now appearance. And we illumine this appearance, pervade it with the real element from the rest of our organism, our metabolism. This represents a germination, initially unfolding in our human condition, but having a cosmic significance. Picture it like this. A person is born on a certain date, and before this he was in the world of spirit. He departs from the world of spirit, insofar as what was previously reality in him now becomes appearance. And into this appearance he introduces the will activity that comes toward him from a quite different direction, surfacing in him from the rest of his organism apart from the head. It is by this means that the past, dying into appearance, is rekindled by what shines out in the will to become the reality of the future. Let us understand this properly. What happens when a person raises himself to pure, or in other words, will-imbued, will-illumined thinking? Based on what appearance has dissolved, the past, a new reality develops in him, taking him toward the future, fertilized by the will rising from his capital I nature. He carries this seed into the future. The real thoughts of the past are the soil, if you like, and what comes from his individuality is implanted into this soil. The seed is sent into the future for a future life. And on the other hand, by imbuing our actions, our will nature, with thoughts, we develop what we accomplish in love. This detaches from us. You see, our actions don't stay with us, but become cosmic occurrence. And when they are filled with love, then love accompanies them on their journey. For the cosmos, an egoistic action is something other than a love-imbued action. We develop appearance, fertilized by will, as something that emerges from within us. And what streams forth from our head into the world encounters our own thought-filled actions. This is like an unfolding plant whose blossom contains the seed that needs outer sunlight, air, and so forth, needs something to come toward it from the cosmos in order for it to grow and ripen. In the same way, what is developed through freedom has to find a growth element in the love coming to meet it in actions. Thus the human being really does stand in the flow of cosmic evolution, and what happens inside his skin and flows out of his skin as actions has meaning not only for him, but is also cosmic occurrence. He participates in the life of the cosmos. Reality continually dissolves as a past reality, becomes appearance within us, and new reality arises as this appearance is in turn fertilized by the will. And here you have to grasp spiritually something we have considered from other perspectives previously. There is no constancy or conservation of matter. This transforms into appearance, which in turn is raised to reality again within the human being through his will. The law of the conservation of matter and energy is an illusion introduced into modern views of the physical world that take account of a natural order only. In fact, matter or substance continually fade away, transforming into appearance, while appearance is transformed again into new existence through what appears before us, provisionally, as the highest creation of the cosmos, the human being. We can also see this at the other pole of the human being, although it is not so easy to discern there, since the processes that lead to freedom can only really be grasped by impartial, open thinking. This discernment requires some degree of spiritual scientific development, as ordinary consciousness initially rebounds from or is rebuffed by force. What comes to expression in force and energy is, however, imbued by thoughts, although ordinary consciousness fails to discern that the world of thought is here informed by evermore will, judgment, and resolve, and that as we introduce thoughts into will nature, and thus increasingly eradicate force, we are penetrating mere force with the light of thought. At one pole of human existence, we find that substance is overcome, while at the other, we see substance arising anew. As outlined in my book titled Riddles of the Soul, we are threefold beings, as you know. Our neurosensory system sustains thinking and sensory perception. Our rhythmic system, breathing and blood circulation, sustains feeling. And our metabolic system sustains the life of will. But how does metabolism unfold in someone who increasingly develops will into love? In loving actions, in fact, substance is continually overcome. And what unfolds in someone who develops pure thinking, which is really will-like in nature, as a free being? Here, substance is created. Thus we can look on as substance arises. We bear within ourselves something that gives rise to new substance, our head. And we also bear within us something that destroys substance, where we can see how substance is annihilated, our limbs or metabolic organism. This is to see the human being as a whole. What is normally otherwise only regarded in abstract terms within human consciousness, in fact participates as a real element in cosmic evolution. And what exists in this evolution as the tangible reality to which ordinary awareness clings and which it cannot conceive of as anything other than real, is dissolved and resolved into nothing. Ordinary consciousness perceives the world as external reality, and where this proves unworkable, resorts instead at least to atoms as fixed realities. Because people cannot detach their thinking from these fixed and rigid realities, they stir these atoms around a little, a bit of this and a bit of that, some hydrogen, some oxygen. And this is because they are unable to do anything else than to conceive of a fixed reality corresponding to their fixed thoughts. To assume the existence of fixed and eternal atoms is nothing but a weakness of thinking. Thinking in accord with reality shows us that substance is continually resolved into nothing. People only speak of the preservation of matter because where substance dies away, new substance continually arises. Here they make the same mistake as someone who, seeing a number of documents taken into a house where they are copied and then burned, and the copies brought out again, assumes that he is seeing the same documents emerging from the house as were taken in. In fact, the old ones have been burned, and new ones have been written. The same is true of processes of growth and development in the world. And it is important to penetrate to this point with one's faculty of insight and perception. You see, precisely where substance passes away in us, becomes appearance, and where new substance arises, the possibility of freedom exists, and the possibility of love. And freedom and love belong together, as I have already mentioned in my book, The Philosophy of Freedom. A worldview in which substance is seen as a constant leaves no room for either freedom on the one hand or love on the other. The feeling of love, which is devotion to something uncompelled by the past, and freedom, which is to act out of something which is not predetermined, are only possible because the past dies in us entirely, becoming appearance, and the future arises anew in entirely germinal form. Freedom and love can actually only be understood by a science of the spirit. Their real nature is beyond the grasp of other outlooks. Anyone who is engaged fully with the worldview emerging in recent centuries will realize how difficult it is to overcome our habitual modes of thinking and make headway with unprejudiced spiritual scientific thinking. In the modern scientific worldview, there are no foundations for grasping the true nature of freedom and love. On a future occasion, we will inquire further into the position inevitably adopted by the scientific worldview on the one hand and old traditional perspectives on the other, toward a really progressive evolution of humanity as described and facilitated by spiritual science. The end of Lecture 12.